is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. The breaking news right now, 6 police officers in Baltimore arrested. We will talk about that later on in the program. In fact, I think probably our second and third hours, we'll have quite a conversation about it. And the other big news yesterday, Senator Bernie Sanders announced that he is running for president of the United States. And I'm so pleased to have Senator Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. He'll be taking your calls, our national town hall meeting. Senator Sanders, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. I was so pleased to hear this announcement yesterday that you are running for president. And the calls yesterday were just amazing. I believe Jim put a bunch of them up on YouTube. I hope you have an opportunity to see them. Tell us your thoughts on why Bernie for president.
Well, I'll tell you, as you know, this is an issue I have been thinking long and hard on. And the reason is that in this nation today, the reason that I'm running is that in this nation today, which is at this moment the wealthiest nation in the history of the world, and we are wealthier today than we have ever been in our history, yet in the midst of all that, we have a middle class which is disappearing. And that means that there are listeners to this show who are not working one job, they're working two jobs, three jobs, trying to cobble together an income and some health care. There are people who are listening to this show who are worrying about how they're going to feed their families tomorrow, because we have almost as many people living in poverty now as any time in the history of this country. So, Tom, the question immediately surfaces. How does it happen that in the wealthiest country in the history of the world, the vast majority of the people are losing ground, and there are a whole lot of people who are suffering, don't have any health insurance, can't afford health care, can't afford dental care, can't afford to send their kids to college, spending half of their incomes on rent? How does that happen? And a lot of that has to do, and the reason that I am running for president, has to do with the greed of corporate America and the billionaire class who apparently want it all. And what we are looking at right now, and is literally a grotesque and obscene level of income and wealth inequality. Now, if you and I had dinner, and I ate 3/4 of the food on your plate, or 90% of the food on your plate after digesting my own food, doesn't sound very good, but that's exactly what's happening in the American economy today. These guys got it all. So when you have a situation where today 99% of all of the new income generated goes to the top 1%, when you have a situation where the top 1/10 of 1%, not 1%, 1/10 of 1% owns almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%, where in the last 2 years alone, the wealthiest 14 people in this country saw their wealth increase by $157 billion, which is more wealth than the bottom 40% have. When you have that incredible disparity and inequality, this is not moral, it's not good economics, and it is certainly not sustainable. So the goal here is not very hard. I mean, the long-term goal is how do we establish an economy and a political system which works for all people? And that's not, I think we know how to do it. The problem is we're going to come up against people who are very, very greedy, very selfish. They want it all. So, that's one reason I'm running for president. The second reason is that I worry very much that not only do the oligarchs control the economy, I worry about their growing influence over the political system as well. Funny, I was just reading an article today describing a candidate who will remain unknown, who was holding I think it was called a low donor fundraiser at $2,700 a person. That's low donor. And the truth is you have people like Jeb Bush who are running around the country raising astronomical sums of money from millionaires. They're getting in a room and people give them $1 million here and $1 million there. And then you have the Koch brothers prepared to spend some $900 million on this election cycle. Sheldon Adelson sitting there in Las Vegas having all the Republicans come to his office to have them tell him what they will do for him. Seeing on the United States Senate floor and in the House piece of legislation after piece of legislation, which is designed to protect the interests of only a handful of people. I'm the ranking member of the Budget Committee, and we're dealing now with the Republican budget, which among many other really horrendous things, does away with the estate tax, which will provide $269 billion in tax breaks to whom? To the top 0.2%. You believe that?
Yeah.
Fewer than 6,000 of the wealthiest families in America. And at the same time, they allow to expire the added benefits we put into the child tax credit and the earned income tax credit, which helps low and moderate income families. So huge tax breaks for billionaires and millionaires and raising taxes on low and moderate income families. That doesn't happen by accident. That happens under the orders, if you like, of the big money interest who fund these campaigns. And unless we overturn the Citizens United, unless we figure out a way to once again recreate a vibrant democracy where every person has a vote, and that's what matters, not how much money you have. And you can see the media, you know, any idiot, and I say this respectfully, who's a billionaire, who wants to run for office, on that day, that person is a very serious candidate. Why? Because he's a billionaire, she's a billionaire. But you have thousands of great people all over this country who know their communities, who know the issues, who are really smart, who want to serve. They can't get involved in politics because they don't, you know, they don't know billionaires, they don't know millionaires. And that's where we're evolving. So you're evolving to a society not only where a handful of families control our economy, but they control the political life of this nation as well. So we've got to deal with these things. You know, what we're trying to do in this campaign is to make it very clear this is not about Bernie Sanders. It is about creating a movement of millions of Americans who stand up proudly and loudly and say enough is enough. This country belongs to all of us. It belongs to the men and women who put their lives on the line to defend us. It belongs to the children. It belongs to our seniors, people who raised us. It belongs to working people. It belongs to the nurses and the doctors. It belongs to all of us, and not just a handful of billionaires who want it all. And that is essentially what this campaign is about.
Yeah, and then also climate change.
And then, of course, climate change. You know, and this one is, you know, there's so many enormous issues out there. You know, some, you know, people often ask, well, what's your top issue? There is no top issue. The collapse of the American middle class, income and wealth inequality, and then you have climate change. You know, Bill McKibben, who lives 30 or 40 miles away from me here in Vermont, who is a good friend, you know, has written time and time and time again and helped organize 350.org. to be one of the largest environmental groups in the world, and you know, makes the point we just don't have unlimited amounts of time. There is a short window of opportunity to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel and into energy efficiency and sustainable energy. But even on this issue, Tom, it gets back to money and politics, because you have folks like the Koch brothers and ExxonMobil. That's how they make their money. They make their money on fossil fuel. And if you think their money is not one of the reasons why you have a Republican Party in Congress, which, with few exceptions, still denies the reality of climate change or the man-made causation of climate change, if you don't think money is the origin of that, you would be surely mistaken, because any Republican who benefits from the Koch brothers or a big energy money who stands up and says, you know what, I think we should listen to the scientists, I think we should transform our energy system away from fossil fuel, that Republican candidate, that Republican would not last long and would be challenged in a primary. So, you know, the issues out there are numerous. I look forward to going all over this country. Obviously, we'll start in the caucus states in New Hampshire and Iowa and South Carolina and Nevada, but we'll be all over the country, and we look forward to working with millions of people to stand up and fight back.
Great. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting. Your opportunity to ask Senator Sanders pretty much any question you'd like. We'll be right back with your calls to Bernie right after this, 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And you can check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. And also, he has quite a presence over on Facebook as well. Check it out. And welcome back. Sharon, in Bellingham, Washington, listening on KBAI. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, Bernie, I love you. Anyway, I've already been swimming this morning, and I got to tell you, the flip turns at the wall were amazing. I was doing flip turns like you couldn't believe. But I've also been talking to people this morning, and I'm not real good at putting myself out there to talk to people. I don't feel like I can spit out facts real well and hold my own. And what I want to know is the people who I've talked to who don't know about you, what is the best place to send them to learn about you?
Well, I think first thought, sanders.senate.gov. We have, as Tom indicated, a very strong website. I think we have far more people on Facebook than any other member of the United States Senate. We have a whole lot of information there. So sanders.senate.gov will have some of my speeches and a lot of the views that I hold.
Great.
Thanks very much, Aaron.
Don in Albuquerque, New Mexico, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Did you say Don?
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Oh, okay. Before I get into my main topic, I would like to have a real quick. I'm retired on Social Security, not real well off, but I have $100 that I have set aside months ago. How do I send it to you?
If you're asking me, I'll tell you. We have a website, a campaign website called BernieSanders.com.
BernieSanders.com?
BernieSanders.com, yeah.
All right, thank you. Now, I have looked, I've done some research. It's kind of hard to find the information, but as far as I've been able to figure out, in the whole history of the Iowa caucuses, except for incumbents, there have only been two winners of the caucuses that have actually gone on to get their party's nomination, one Democrat and one Republican. So basically, they get it wrong like 90% of the time, and yet the media acts like these people are oracles, and just, I don't understand it. Why is it that people think how people in Iowa vote is important?
Well, Don, thanks. I'm not an expert on this. I'm learning more about it every day, but Iowa is the first caucus, so the media will pay an enormous amount of attention to it, followed very shortly after by New Hampshire, and then I think you got South Carolina and Nevada. But it is, let me just tell you, it is my intention, while we pay a lot of attention to those states, we think we have support all over the United States of America, and we intend to run a 50-state strategy. I was recently in South Carolina, which is, and I've been to Mississippi, and I've been to Alabama, and I've been to North Carolina in the last number of years. And I think people underestimate so-called red states in this country in terms of the potential for progressives to do well. I think there is a lot of angst and anxiety in these states. Many of them are some of the poorest states in America. And I think if we are prepared to invest in those states, work hard in those states, we can surprise them.
We're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. We'll be back with more of your questions from the Senator right after this. Welcome back. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, and back to the phone lines, right, Senator?
Yep.
Okay. Marco in Houston, Texas. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders, and hello, Mr. Hartman. Thank you. It is an honor to have this opportunity. And now, Mr. Sanders, my question is, what are your thoughts on programs such as NASA or corporations such as Elon Musk, SpaceX, in regards to their goals and, of course, space exploration?
Well, I applaud Mr. Musk. Clearly, we have got to transform our transportation system and our energy system away from fossil fuel. I think we've been very slow in moving in that direction. The idea of moving aggressively toward hybrid cars or electric cars and the idea of generating our electricity in a sustainable manner is, to me, extremely important. I think we have huge potential in solar. We have seen an explosion of solar in recent years, and while the Obama administration has tried to do the right thing, they have been met time and time again by obstructionism from the Republicans. So I think if we invest heavily in innovation, in new technologies, we can, in fact, transform our energy system away from fossil fuel. I think we can move aggressively toward the electrification of our transportation system, and that's the direction I would like to see us go.
Connor in Atlanta, Georgia, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, me?
You are. That's you.
Senator Sanders, thank you very much for taking my call. I, too, believe that socioeconomic status transcends pretty much every other problem that any American can have. So I'm asking you this. Are you in support of ending the war on drugs?
Yeah, in general, I am, of course. You know, I think we want to be aggressive in going after those heavy-duty drug dealers who are trying to, you know, poison children. But we have jails all across this country which are filled with nonviolent drug users who need treatment and not jail cells. So I think there is a growing sentiment, which I strongly support, to undo some of the structures of this war on drugs, which have caused just an enormous amount of human suffering and huge expenditures of dollars.
Glenn in State College, Pennsylvania. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. I was so happy to sign up. I would like to know, I feel there are people like me who, even though we knew you were going to announce, were just overjoyed when we heard it. Because one more time, one of the few times in my life, I get to vote for someone who represents me. And I think there's a sleeping giant of people just begging for someone like you to come along and awaken us. And I'm just hoping I can help and do that. How can we help?
Well, Glenn,
we're rolling in money.
Thanks so much for
Glenn, thanks.
The campaign website is BernieSanders.com, so you can sign up there. And we are absolutely going to be running, and our major emphasis is going to be on a grassroots campaign, mobilizing a whole lot of people all across this country. But, Glenn, this is what I want to say. This, and I say this humbly, and I mean it sincerely. This really is not about Bernie Sanders. I will do my job. I'm a senator. I do my job for Vermont. I'll be a candidate, and I'm going to do my job for the American people, and I am running to win this thing. But what I've said before, let me repeat again, that if we had the best president that you can imagine, the smartest person, the hardest working person, the most honest person, there are absolute limits to what that person can accomplish so long as we have this incredible a concentration of power in Washington, D.C., and wealth and lobbyists and all this stuff. The only way that we make changes, Glenn, is when millions of people literally stand up, get their neighbors involved in the political process, that we transform politics in America from being a spectator sport to one where all of us are actively involved. We are not going to change America if, as in the case of the last midterm election, 63% of the people don't vote and 80% of young people don't vote, and where a majority of Americans probably don't even know where their member of Congress is. You don't change America under those conditions. You change America by activating the consciousness of people, getting them involved in the political process, letting their representatives know that they know what's going on, and if they don't do the right thing for working people, they're out of their jobs. That's what we've got to do together, and that's going to be the theme of this election. It's not just vote for Bernie Sanders. He's going to solve all the problems. That ain't the case. It's going to be millions of people standing up together, state by state, community by community. And Glenn, thanks so much for your support. Look forward to working with you in Pennsylvania.
Senator, we just have a minute left before the break here.
Titled the theme of this campaign is a political revolution.
Mm.
And again, it's not vote for me. You know, I'm terrific and I'm great. It is, hey, we got to do this together. We have to do this together. That's the only way you win campaigns. And that's the only way you make change. You know, Tom, as you well know, you know, civil rights movement didn't happen because Martin Luther King Jr. was there. It happened because for decades, millions of people marched and went to jail and in some cases died to stand up and fight for change. And the same way with the women's movement or the gay movement. It happens from below. People can organize, they stand up. That's what we've got to do now in terms of economics and politics in this country.
Join the movement. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Sanders will be back with more of your calls for Bernie right after this break. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And you check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. And also, you can find him over on Facebook and he's all over the internet. Twenty-eight minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. And Jim in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello.
Hey, Jim.
Hi. Hey, I met you guys at the Sister Giant conference here. It was pretty awesome. I gave you a letter. I was hoping it was my letter that convinced you to run. Anyhow, it's a great day for America, and I'm ready to work. I'm sure you know how important it is to win back the House and the Senate in order for any president to get anything done. I was wondering if you have a game plan for that.
Sure. The game plan is a pretty simple one, Jim, and thanks for your support. The game plan is to substantially increase voter turnout, to get people who have given up on the political process reactivated, to reach out to young people who in the last election, 80% of them didn't vote, to make them aware that politics is not a joke. What happens in Washington and in state capitals will impact their lives and is the future of this country. So what we have got to do is to educate, we've got to organize, we've got to motivate, and we have to greatly increase the voter turnout. The Republican political game plan is not hard to understand. They do everything they can to make it as hard as possible for people to vote, especially poor people or older people. And they're into voter suppression to a very significant degree, and they want everybody to have an ID card and a driver's license. And it's a little bit difficult if you don't have the money to buy a car or if you're too old to drive. But their job is to suppress the vote, and our job is to substantially increase the vote to make it as easy as easy as possible for people to participate in our democracy. So we want legislation. I've introduced legislation, you know, that would create a national holiday on Election Day, which I think is a very important idea. But bottom line is voter turnout is where it's at. And Jim, we've got to do, all of us got to do everything we can. And when our people vote, we win. And when people don't vote and big money dominates the political process, they win. And that's the dynamic. And that's what we've got to do is bring out large numbers of people.
Mike in Chicago, listening on WCPT, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, it's great to talk to you. I'm a lifelong Democrat, and since 1993, Clinton, I believe, started the big Wall Street kind of takeover of the Democratic Party. And I believe with these trade deals, Obama has continued it. So my question to you is, as a lifelong independent, what will it take for you to not say, I'm an independent running a Democratic primary, but I'm a Democrat running in the Democratic primary? Thank you.
Well, Mike, you know, I have been an independent my entire career here in the state of Vermont. That's how I was on the ballot as a mayor and as a congressman and as a senator. In fact, on two occasions, I did win the Democratic primaries here working with Democrats. We knew it was going to happen, and I won the primaries, and I respectfully declined the nomination to stay on the ballot as an independent. So in my heart, I am an independent. I've always been an independent. But obviously, having made the choice to run within the Democratic primary process, I will do whatever secretaries of state require and whatever state laws require to be on the ballot as a Democrat. But I should also tell you that while I've been elected as an independent, I have caucused with the Democrats for my first day in the House of Representatives. So I've been part of the Democratic caucus in the House and Senate for 24 years. Today, I am the ranking member of the Budget Committee appointed by the minority leader, Harry Reid. Was formerly the chairman of the Veterans Committee, appointed by Harry Reid. So in the Senate, I operate as if I were a Democrat while I'm an independent, and I think that process can work just fine as we go forward. But we look forward to being actively involved in this primary process and win this. going to be tough, but I think we could do that.
Josh in Madison, Wisconsin, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders, Tom Hartman. It's an honor to be on the air with both of you. I can't wait to help you, Bernie, with your campaign. I just wanted to preface my question with FDR quote from his first inaugural address, and that is, in every dark hour of our national life, a leadership of frankness and of vigor has met with that understanding and support of the people themselves, which is essential to victory. I feel that fits your campaign very well. And my question is, I think I already know the answer, but can we count on you to give a new deal, FDR-type new deal to the people, and maybe even a second Bill of Rights that guarantees health care as a right?
Josh, thanks. Great question, and thanks for that quote. Tom, refresh my memory here, but I believe that FDR, in response to Josh's good question, it didn't get a whole lot of publicity because I think it was toward the end of the war.
Yeah.
But he did propose a second Bill of Rights, was focusing on economic issues. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes.
I saw that. I think Michael Moore had that in his film, didn't he?
Yeah, as I recall. And Harvey Kay wrote a great book about it, the second Bill of Rights.
It was a very strong. So to answer Josh's excellent question, let me just say this. All of us believe, I believe, I won't speak for all of us, that the Constitution of the United States is truly a remarkable document, given that it was written over 200 years ago by people who had a lot of intelligence and were thinking well into the future. But I also, when we talk about freedom, freedom is not just the right to say what you want to say. That's First Amendment and terribly important. Freedom is not just the right to assemble and all of the rights that are in the Bill of Rights. Freedom is something more. Freedom, to my mind, means that you have to have the security to be able to live a full and happy life. And you know what? If you're worrying about how your family is going to be fed tomorrow, I don't think you're free. And if you are worried about whether or not you can get to a doctor's office when you or your kids are sick, I don't think that that is what freedom is about as well. So freedom means the full right of expression, the right of privacy, all of those things. And I voted against the USA Patriot Act, and I believe in that very, very strongly. But I also believe in economic security. If you are listening to this program right now, and you are 90 years of age, and you're trying to survive on $13,000 a year Social Security, that's pretty tough. That's pretty tough. So I think what Josh is saying is when we talk about freedom, it also has to mean economic security. And I 100% agree with that. Healthcare, to my mind, is a right. I'm hoping to lead the fight in the Senate not only to prevent cuts to Social Security, but in fact to expand Social Security benefits. This is, as I mentioned earlier, the richest country in the history of the world. 45 million Americans should not be living in poverty. 35 million Americans should not have zero health insurance, while many others have large deductibles and copayments. Young people should not be nervous. Bright young people should not be nervous about whether or not they can afford to go to college. We can, if we stand together, transform this country in a very profound way. And certainly, that will be a key message of this campaign.
Richard in Leominster, Massachusetts. I know that's not how it's pronounced. How do you say your town, Richard?
Leominster.
Leominster, no, thank you. There you go. You're on the air.
Tom, you weren't even close on that one.
I know. I'm so sorry. Okay, Richard.
I listened to you speak on C-SPAN last summer, and you said 45,000 people died last year because they didn't have health care.
Yeah.
And yet they spent $3 trillion on these wars because 3,000 people died in 9/11. Does that make any sense?
Well, I think two things. Thank you for your question, Richard. I think the number was 42,000, and hopefully that number may have gone down with an expansion of health care through the Affordable Care Act. But what nobody ever talks about is a study, Richard, was done in your state at Harvard University some years ago. And some clinicians looked at the numbers, and they estimated, I won't swear to you now, but I think the number was 42,000 people every single year die because if they don't have health insurance and you don't have money, you delay going to the doctor. You don't go to the doctor. And by the time you walk into the doctor's office, it is often too late. And I have talked to many, many physicians in Vermont, other places in this country. They say, yeah, people walk in the door. It's terminal. We can't help them. And so if you have universal health care, and I believe in a Medicare for all single-payer system, if you have accessible health care, so that if you are feeling ill today, you can walk into a doctor's office and get treatment today. When that happens, we will save tens of thousands of lives every single year, and that's a fact.
And in the 40 seconds or so we have left, you will also save a lot of money, right?
Absolutely. This system, Tom, don't get me going. you touch a sore nerve. This system is so dysfunctional. We spend so much money, and we get so relatively little value. We spend almost twice as much as the people of any other country on major country on earth that guarantee health care to all people, and yet the health indices, the results that we get for what we spend often is not as positive as other countries. So it's a largely dysfunctional system with a huge amount of waste in it.
It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Sanders taking your calls, answering your questions in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. We'll be right back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out Bernie's website, Sanders.Senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz, his newsletter, and it's a great news website as well. And welcome back, Dave in Canton, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, hello.
Hello, Dave.
Yes, thank you. It's a privilege to be able to speak with you. I'm calling about national health care.
And your question for the Senator, yes. Dave?
Yes, it's about national health care. My plan is to reform the federal income tax and replace it with a national sales tax and use half of that national sales tax to pay for national health care. It's $100,000 with no federal income tax for anyone from the first $100,000. 15% national sales tax, half of that to pay for national health care. Okay. Any plan that we can present to the American people that makes common sense, they will more than happily walk to the polls and vote for it.
Okay, Dave, let's get Bernie's thoughts on that.
Well, Dave, I believe in a national health care program. I believe in a Medicare for All single-payer program. I think it's a bit absurd that the United States remains the only major country on earth that doesn't guarantee health care to all people. And as I just mentioned, we end up spending almost twice as much per capita on health care as other nations, and yet we're left with 35 million people who have no health insurance and even more who are underinsured. So clearly, we have got to move forward to guarantee health care to all people as a right. Now, if you do that and you say health care is a right of all people, you need to fund it publicly. And to do that, you're going to have to, while we do away with private health insurance costs, so people are not paying for their Blue Cross Blue Shield or the Aetna or whatever they're paying for, they will have to pay more in taxes. And the question is how you do that in a progressive and fair way. My view in general is that at a time when we have massive levels of income and wealth inequality, and I mentioned earlier, some 99% of all new income today is going to the top 1%, you have, you know, the 14 wealthiest people making several hundred billion dollars more in wealth, seeing more wealth than they did a few years ago, that under those conditions, what you need is a very progressive income tax and a fair corporate tax, which ends many of the loopholes that corporations currently enjoy. And I think you do that, and I think if you create a simpler healthcare system, not this complicated bureaucratic one, which is geared to make huge money, amounts of money for the insurance companies and the drug companies. If you do that, I think we can provide quality care to all Americans in a fair way.
Okay. Jordan in Chillicothe, Ohio. We have just a minute to the break. Real quick question for the senator, Jordan.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you for taking my call. And, Bernie, thank you for deciding to run. My question is, Bernie, I know you support rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure. I was wondering if you support building solar roadways to help combat climate change as well as taking care of our crumbling roads.
Great point. Not enough that I know definitively, but I think there are huge, huge, huge opportunities for solar, and that may well be one of them. I just can't speak definitively because I haven't studied it. But I did, I can tell you, Jordan, that I introduced legislation for 10 million solar rooftops so that people would get financial help in establishing solar rooftops on their own homes or buildings that they own. And utilizing solar in the most effective way that we possibly can is something that I'm keenly interested in.
We'll be right back with more of your questions for Senator Sanders right after this. Be sure to check out Bernie's website, by the way, at sanders.senate.gov. Minutes before the hour, Voice for Despair is not an option. The Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Sanders taking your calls. Marcia in Angier, North Carolina. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Congratulations, Senator Sanders. I got a couple of things. Less than
Marcia, I can hardly understand you. Are we on the speakerphone?
Can you hear me now? No.
No, it sounds all muffled. Is your thumb over the microphone or something?
No, it's
that I've got you. Okay, Marcia, I can't understand you. I'm going to have to put you on hold, and maybe you and Danielle can figure out. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, good afternoon, Senator Sanders.
Yep.
I'll be honest with you. I was thinking about voting for Hillary until you entered the race. And, you know, and I guess old habits are hard to break, so I'm going to open my mind to up to you, you know, as far as when you start debating and give you a fair shot as well. But my question today is basically execution of the mentally ill. I think I'd be more inclined to vote for you if you was to sign a executive order to stop or make a stay on executions on the mentally ill. I think the right wing is actually using that as subliminally, you know, as a way so that we can be afraid of them.
Yeah. And Charles, let's get Bernie's
Charles,
opinion on this.
Thanks. You raise an important question. And let me just give you an answer that I suspect not everybody will agree with. But I'm against capital punishment in general. I understand, and certainly for people who are mentally incapacitated, who don't know what they're doing or even what's happening to them. I think people have been executed who really were not even aware of what was going on. And that's not something that a civilized nation should be engaged in. But in general, this is what I think. Look, there are people who commit horrendous, horrendous, horrendous crimes. We all know that. And we are furious at them. We can't understand their barbarity. But I think as with so much violence in this world today, I just don't think the state itself, whether it's state government or the federal government, should be in the business of killing people. So when you have people who have done terrible, terrible things, they're going to spend the rest of their lives in jail, and that's a pretty harsh punishment. But I am against capital punishment.
Helen in Ithaca, New York, listening on 1470 AM. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, hi. My name's Helen. Congratulations. I'm so happy that you're running for the candidacy and that you're running for it seriously. You're not going to be like a debating partner for Hillary Clinton or anything.
No, that's correct, Helen. You're right.
Yes, and I'm going to work for you, and I already sent you a check, but I hope I get a like cool T-shirt or something.
All right, we'll work on that.
I've been reading for months and hearing over the radio and stuff. People are critical of you. They say that you, both you and Elizabeth Warren, you excel in domestic policy, but you kind of don't know anything about foreign policy. So since this world is in a bit of a quagmire, I would say, like what's going on in the Middle East and in Africa, and I also, I'm not, all my grandparents are from Ireland, okay, so.
Helen, what's your question?
Right, my question is, like, what do you, You've got to, like, bone up on that.
Okay, you're asking Bernie his position on foreign.
Okay, Helen asked a good question. And
in the Middle East.
Look, the truth is, Helen is right in saying that most of the work that I have done in the Congress and the committees that I've been on, that I wanted to get on, have focused around economic issues and healthcare issues and the needs of kids, the needs of the elderly, needs of veterans. I was chairman of the Veterans Committee. That's true. And that is where most of my focus has been. But Helen is also right, is that if you are president of the United States, you obviously have got to be extremely knowledgeable about foreign policy. And Helen, you'll hear me talking more about that. But this is what I do want to tell you. I do know something about it. And that is that way back, right after I was elected, literally a few months after I was elected to Congress in 1991, I had to face a vote on whether or not we get involved in the first Gulf War. And I voted against it. And then I had to vote on the war in Iraq. And I not only voted against that war, but I helped lead the opposition to that war because I feared very much what could happen, the destabilizing effect that that war would have. So, you know, I have cast some very significant foreign policy votes and have been active on some issues. But Helen is right. Foreign policy is an enormously important part of what any president has to deal with. And I will be speaking out forcefully and hopefully intelligently on those issues.
Senator, we have a minute and a half left. You want to get another call in, or would you like to
one
more call? Okay. Troy in Chicago, listening to WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Quick one.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Senator Sanders. I was really stoked about you announcing your bid for candidacy yesterday, and I've donated and will be volunteering. I was just wondering, Senator Sanders, are you any aware that Occupy Movement has endorsed you for a presidency? And that was pretty much my question for.
Well, as a matter of fact, somebody just told me that literally within the last hour or so, just before I went on the air. And I appreciate that. The Occupy Movement, as I have said many times on this show, played a very, very important role in focusing attention on two major issues that we face as a nation. Number one, the power and greed of Wall Street, and I happen to believe, and we'll be speaking at some length on this issue, that we need to break up these huge and powerful financial institutions. And the second role that Occupy Wall Street has played is to talk about income and wealth inequality, and that's certainly going to be a central theme of my campaign. So I want to thank all of the people in the Occupy Movement for the very important work that they have done, and we look forward to working with them in the coming months.
That's great. 20 seconds. Oh, 2 seconds. All right. Senator Sanders, I wish you the very best, and thank you so much for being with us today. I look forward to talking with you next Friday.
Okay, Tom. Thank you very much. Take care.
Thank you, sir. Senator Bernie Sanders. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This
is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Freddie Gray is dead, and six police officers have had arrest warrants issued for them. I haven't checked in the last hour as to whether they've turned themselves in or they've been arrested or whatnot. But the charges, second-degree depraved heart murder, is a 30-year sentence for Officer Caesar Goodson. Apparently, he's the guy who was driving the car or the van that Freddie died in. Involuntary manslaughter, 10 years. Second-degree assault, 10 years. Gross negligent manslaughter by vehicle, 10 years. Criminal negligent manslaughter, 3 years. Misconduct in office. Officer William Porter is facing 20 years involuntary manslaughter and second-degree assault. Lieutenant Brian Rice is looking at 20 years involuntary manslaughter, 2 counts of second-degree assault, 10 years each. I guess that's 30 years. 2 counts of misconduct in office, false imprisonment. Officer Edward Nero, 2 counts of second-degree assault, 10 years in jail, false imprisonment, misconduct in office. Garrett Miller, Officer Garrett Miller, 2 counts of second-degree assault, 10 years each, 2 counts of misconduct in office, false imprisonment. And Sergeant Alicia White, involuntary manslaughter, 10 years, second-degree assault, 10 years, misconduct in office. Baltimore State Attorney Marilyn Mosby talked about this morning and talked also about how she is the daughter of 2 police officers, both her parents. Her grandfather started the first African-American Police Officers Association in the state of Massachusetts back in the day. He's apparently passed on. And the thing that blew my mind about this, I mean, I watched her announcement this morning, and there was one point where I had tears in my eyes. I mean, it takes a lot to provoke me, but I mean, I think we're witnessing, and reality check this with me, I think we're witnessing an actual tipping point, an actual transformational moment in the history of this country. I think it's being driven by technology. I think it's being driven by the fact that we now see the things that, and by we, I'm talking in large part the white community in the United States, is now seeing the horrors that the black community in the United States faces literally daily at the hands of police officers all over this country. And this disruptive technology of these cell phone cameras is just awesome what it's doing. I don't know if you've seen this website, Killed by Police, by killedbypolice.net. So far this year, since January 1st, 392 people have been killed by police officers in the United States. Now, in Great Britain, it's 2 over the last 10 years, if my recollection of that statistic is correct. But here in the United States, just since January 1st, today is May 1st, happy May Day, by the way, just since January 1st, 392 people have been killed by police officers. You can see the entire list over at killedbypolice.net. And we got a problem in this country. And one of the things that I thought was really extraordinary was that Baltimore State Attorney Marilyn Mosby did not go to a grand jury. She didn't do the whole little song and dance where the grand jury hangs out with the cops and hangs out with the prosecutors and they all get, you know, and hey, isn't it, you know, the Ferguson dance, right? She just brought charges. It's like, wow. Now, on the other hand, there has been, in my opinion, nowhere near enough coverage about what has happened both to Kevin Moore and to Ramsey Orta. Ramsey Orta is the guy who filmed the death of Eric Garner in New York City. And basically the cops hunted him down and arrested him. And the guy who filmed the Freddie Gray arrest, and why the media doesn't acknowledge his name and his situation every time they play that video, I don't know. But they should. Kevin Moore filmed Freddie Gray's arrest. He gave that video to the police. He talked with the police. They knew who he was. He also gave it to the media. And then after he gave the video to the police, according to Kevin Moore, he himself, well, firstly, the Baltimore police issued a photo of him and said, can anybody help identify this guy? When they are apparently already, according to him, already knew who he was. In fact, his comment when he was with the Cop Watch group, right? And his comment when he put it out was, he says, and then they put his picture out. He says, what's so important that you have to plaster my picture all over the internet? I've already spoken. How do you not know that that picture is me? I mean, that's me. I know that's all 6'5", 260 pounds of me. For the police to post that picture and say they don't know who I am, that's BS. You know who I am. And he says, by the way, that Freddie Gray was folded up like origami. But we have to, you know, I think the next step, and the Supreme Court has already weighed in on this, but it's apparently not filtered down or something. We've got to protect people who are, you know, as these Cop Watch programs are growing, who are keeping an eye on the people who are supposed to be serving and protecting us, not, you know, occupying and terrorizing us. And there are many good cops in this country, and there are many good police departments who actually do serve and protect, but there are way too many bad cops in this country. There are way too many cops who the opportunity to beat the crap out of somebody is like, oh boy. And we've got a serious policing problem that we need to do something about. So anyhow, my rant on that, I think it's a fine thing. The other point, by the way, that Marilyn Mosby made in the context of pointing out that she's the daughter of two police officers, the granddaughter of a police officer, is that these six officers being indicted in Baltimore does not mean that the Baltimore Police Department is being indicted. That the Baltimore Police Department and the police chief, I believe, is going to be holding a press conference, or maybe it's the mayor is going to be holding a press conference any minute now. That the police department, they're working on reforming this police department. Now, you know, Baltimore cops have a pretty bad, you know, reputation for police violence. They've paid out over $6 million as a consequence of people suing them for police brutality just in the last couple of years. So, you know, it's a serious issue. But the sense that I got this morning, and it's and I mean, here's the sad irony about it. The sense that I got this morning is that we have hit a tipping point. Things are changing. And the sad part about it is that it took this long for essentially the white power structure of this country and the clueless white people out there who, you know, just don't know what life is like for African Americans, don't have any sense of it, to finally just be slapped upside the head by these videos and wake up. The other thing is, you know, Baltimore has a black mayor, a chief of police, and this state's attorney was African American. People say, oh, it doesn't matter. I think it does. Now, you know, that said, I would hope that if it was a white mayor and a white chief of police and a white prosecutor, that they would have done the same thing. But history seems to indicate that that's not how it works. So, anyhow, my thoughts on all that. I'd like to pick up yours. We'll from here forward now, anything goes Friday. Any topic you want to talk about, we can talk about Bernie. We can talk about what's going on in Baltimore. Whatever you'd like. 15 minutes past it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
My theory on the existence of life in outer space. So interesting. Harvey will be up in a bit. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And John in Birchwood, Wisconsin, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Well, Tom, thanks for taking my call. Very powerful moves you just had there. But I'll get right to my question here. Love Bernie Sanders' ideas, but how in the world is this guy going to raise the kind of money that's necessary to become president of this country?
Well, the variation on that question, John, is how in the world could anybody raise enough money to get, you know, 500,000 or 1 million people out on the out in the streets to protest wealth inequality in the United States and the banksters robbing us blind? The Occupy movement did it, and they didn't need billionaires. They didn't have billionaires. In fact, the very much the opposite. When Jamie Dimon, I believe it was, and J.P. Morgan Chase gave a multi-million dollar donation to the New York Police, union or benevolent fund or party fund or whatever it was, that was when they started really cracking down hard on those Occupy Wall Street protesters. But the point is that organized people can have an effect. They can beat organized money. And so I can't speak for Bernie's campaign. I'm not inside it. I don't, you know, I've had no conversations with them other than what I, you know, when Bernie's on the air, what I can and can't say on the radio, to be legal within the campaign finance rules and things like that. But my sense of it is that that Bernie intends to win nationally the way he wins with well over 70% of the vote, by the way, in Vermont. And Vermont, you know, they say, oh, it's a very liberal state. No, the northern third of Vermont is very conservative, and parts of southern Vermont are quite conservative. But I think he's going to, you know, he points out that when he ran for Senate, and I don't know if it was his run for Senate this time or the one before that, but I remember the last, you know, one of the last two campaigns that he ran, his opponent came in, he was a guy from Massachusetts who'd come into Vermont to run against Bernie, and he put $5 million of his own money into the campaign, Bernie's opponent, and bought all his television time. Bernie did not run one single television ad to become, to get reelected as the senator from Vermont. Not one single television ad. And although his opponents did. So, you know, and everything that they did was grassroots. So, you know, if each one of us can, you know, get 5, 10, 2 or 3 people to say, okay, I'll help out, you know, whether it's helping out by sending $10, you know, BernieSanders.com is the fundraising, or is the campaign site, his campaign site where people can donate. Whether it's people doing that, or whether it's people saying, okay, you know, send me some lawn signs. I'll go door to door and see if I can get them, you know, put in people's lawns, or send me some bumper stickers and I'll start putting them on cars, or say, you know, I don't even know if their campaign has all this stuff yet. I'm hoping that they do. But, you know, it may take a little time. I mean, the election's a year and a half away. So, am I making sense, John? Does that sound like a strategy?
Absolutely. I'm a fan. I'm curious because I know it takes such an extraordinary amount of money to accomplish this. And I'm a fan and I'm going to do what I can. I just kind of wanted to know that there was hope there that he could possibly pull this off. You know,
well, he's done it for 20 some odd years in Vermont. And that's the, you know, it's easier in a small state. There's only 600,000 people in Vermont, and probably every single one of them has shaken Bernie's hand at least 3 times over the last 20 years. But he's going to take that strategy national, and it's a variation of Howard Dean's 50-state strategy, and I think it has a very, very real possibility of working. John, thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Harbin here with you. And John in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, John, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. I've been following you since you've been in Vermont. It's a pleasure to talk
with
you. I believe you and your listeners have enormously helped push Bernie or persuade him to run for president. And I thank you and your listeners for doing that. Also, I think you're right about the tipping point. I think there is a tipping point going on right now, and I think Bernie is part of that tipping point, but I certainly hope you're right about the race relations and so on and so forth. My question, Tom, for you is, do you know if Bernie will still be available for you throughout his campaign?
For Brunch with Bernie? As far as I know, when back in the day, and I don't remember how long ago it was, but it was the last time, as I recall, it was the last time that Bernie was running for the House of Representatives from Vermont. And the Democratic candidate, cried foul, apparently, about his being on my program. And so, you know, we had to go learn about campaign finance laws and all that kind of stuff. And what I learned at that time, and I'm assuming that this applies now, I had a brief conversation with one of Bernie's staff guys this morning, and they're checking with their lawyers. But as far as we know, as long as Bernie only responds to, as long as Bernie doesn't make an overt pitch for money or votes, and only mentions his campaign website, BernieSanders.com, in response to a direct question from someone, then it's just a news interview or it's just a news appearance, and it's absolutely just fine. You know, there's, in other words, there's some parameters that we have to dance around, but we always do
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
We always do that. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. even though Bernie hasn't been running for anything for a long time, he's got Bernie.org is his, mm-hmm. his, you know, running for the Senate and running for the House website. And I have, you know, ever since that first campaign when the Democratic Party in Vermont was, you know, upset with us, I just don't mention it on the air ever when Bernie is on with me, and neither does he. And so as far as I know, and again, we're going to check with their lawyers again, because this is a presidential race, which may have somewhat different rules than congressional and Senate. But as far as I know, and as far as his staff knows, you know, within those very subtle parameters and generally, you know, and Danielle, when she's answering the phone, she's, you know, asking people to let's not talk about money, right? Let's not talk to Bernie about money. Let's talk about issues. And if
well,
we
thanks
can
for doing that, Tom, it's been I think it's been a real service to the country having him available to.
I agree.
What he
and
does.
The other thing is, you know, in terms of equal time, if Hillary Clinton wants to come on this program for an hour a week and answer questions from listeners,
that would be something.
If Ted Cruz wants to come on this program an hour a week and answer questions from listeners, if Rand Paul wants to come on this program, the door is open. The door is absolutely open. If any of these presidential candidates, they want to do it once, if they want to do it once a week, we are equal time. And I, you know, if they want it.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, you're welcome, John. Thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Ivan in Chicago. Hey, Ivan, what's up?
Hey, what's up, Tom? Great show.
Thank you.
I love Bernie. Everybody knows that has any common sense that what America needs, number one, is a massive infrastructure jobs bill, which President Obama has tried to put in place since he became president.
Mm-hmm.
What's holding us back are these wars in the Middle East. Depending on what economist you listen to, it's anywhere from three, and as Joseph Stiglitz said, I think, $13 trillion.
Right, that George Bush whizzed away.
We untangle ourselves from these wars. Unfortunately, the GOP teabags have taken over, and with this Christian fundamentalist end of times philosophy, they do not want peace in the Middle East.
Right. Yeah, there's a large subset within the evangelical Christian community that believes that we're in the end times, and that this goes back to Hal Lindsey publishing The Late Great Planet Earth back in 72, I think it was. I remember reading the book and being actually quite startled by it. The biblical prophecy, and that, you know, part of that biblical prophecy is that the temple has to be rebuilt in Jerusalem, which is right now where the Dome of the Rock Mosque is, and which is why Alan Goodman tried to put a tent there three decades ago, and he ended up getting arrested for that. But that the second temple has to be rebuilt, and then there has to be a war in the Middle East, and all the Jews in Israel, except for 144,000 of them, die, and those 144,000 become Christians, and then Jesus appears, and the world is new all over again. I mean, this the short version of it, but that's and that strain is that it's kind of the Michelle Bachmann strain that runs through the Republican Party. It's totally strange.
And it's when you think about it, Tom, it's anti-peace.
Yes. Yeah.
You can't have a two-state solution.
Yeah.
With that attitude.
Yeah.
And the GOP has been hijacked by these people.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the question, that's an interesting, what your statement raises an interesting question is, did the religious right hijack the GOP, or did the GOP hijack the religious right? Because I, you know, going back to my theory that the Republican Party is made up of rich people, well-paid shills for rich people, and the suckers that the shills bring in. Increasingly, I'm seeing these megachurch pastors and these TV preachers, the Pat Roberts and the Mike Huckabees of the world, as the well-paid shills who are bringing in the suckers. And the suckers are these fundamentalist Christians. So it seems that maybe the GOP has hijacked part of Christianity. Who knows? Ivan, thanks for the call. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program after the news at the bottom of the hour. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
So if any of the other candidates took us up on the offer, what would those hours be called? Hotcakes with Hillary? What with Cruz? I don't know. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And where did Harvey go? Ah, there he is. Harvey in Berkeley. You're Berkeley, California. You're on the air, Harvey. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, I'd like to talk about. First of all, I want to thank Bernie for running for president. Great, it's incredible. And since we are gearing up for space travel, and we're already on the moon, we have our rovers on Mars, and we're discovering possible. Our astronomers are discovering possible habitable worlds out there. I'd like to share some thoughts on life in the universe. I believe that we live between three oceans, the ocean of water, the ocean of air, and the ocean of space. And we occupy the middle ocean, but we penetrate the other two oceans. And when we go to the bottom of the ocean, where we think there's no possibility of life and our bath escapes, we find life around these vents, these volcanic vents, all kinds of life. They're called extremophiles. And when we drill cores deep into the earth, we find bacteria living miles down that have nothing to do with sunlight. They don't exist on things that we think.
We have life forms that don't even use oxygen. They use sulfur, for example.
That's right. And so here's my theory, that there's actually life living in space itself. And these creatures have adapted to space, and they might draw nutrition from landing on meteorites and commons and comets and turning that material into food for themselves. Plus, we know that comets, a lot of them are made of water, and so there could be water. And I feel just as barnacles affix themselves to the bottoms of boats in our ocean, so that these potential life forms might be space barnacles, and they might attach themselves to our spaceships and actually jeopardize the integrity of our spaceships. And I believe that the universe is teeming with life, and it's time to join them, and it's as we birth to the stars.
I agree. I absolutely agree, Harvey. And I there's no way we live in a dead universe. No way. There's just, it's very simple. Thanks for the call. Lee in Reddington, Connecticut. Hey, Lee, thanks for listening to Tune In. What's up?
Hey there. You can hear me this time.
Pardon?
Can you hear me this time?
I can hear you, yes.
We had a really bad phone connection a couple weeks ago. And I was going to bring up the same point. The topic was another candidate had entered the race and immediately is sort of compared to what his chances are winning against Hillary Clinton. This is happening again with Bernie Sanders, and I think real progressives that, the people that have the ear of the public, like talk show hosts such as yourself, and I'm not including you in this, but, they immediately, Bernie Sanders is sort of kind of marginalized in this sort of, he'll be great for the debates, but not really seriously considerable as someone who could beat Hillary.
Yep.
And I just find that to be incredibly damaging to the prospect of actual progress moving forward, really desperately need. And I'm sorry, but I just don't believe that Hillary is that person.
Well, let me, I've been looking for a piece of paper here while you were talking in response to what you're saying. And this is, and I found it. This is the public policy polling from 2007, June 4th, 2007. Okay. So that's, this was basically the exact, roughly the exact, I mean, today's May 1st, so it's 4 weeks off roughly, but it's basically the exact same time in the election cycle, right? A year and a half out from the election. And in that, the public policy polling on that, at that point in time, Barack Obama had 17%. He was polling at 17% to become the Democratic nominee. Right now, on April 28th, this is like 4 days ago, 3 days ago, public policy polling released a new poll showing that Bernie Sanders is polling at 14%. So, you know, and at this exact point, Barack Obama was polling at 17% back, you know, in the last election cycle. So, you know, and everybody was saying, oh, Barack Obama, he's only polling 17%. There's no way he's going to win. You know, it's not going to happen. I'm not dismissive of Bernie's campaign at all. And I wish that more of the media would look at these kind of numbers and take this seriously. I'm with you, Lee. Thanks a lot for the call. Sarah in Mount Juliet, Tennessee. Hey, Sarah, what's up?
Yes, sir. You just kind of read my mind. This morning,
mm-hmm.
Bill Press, Stephanie Miller, and your show, vote for Bernie.
Mm-hmm.
That's the message I want to get out. That's the message I want to tell that, oh, my gosh, I live in a red state
mm-hmm.
here in Tennessee.
Yep.
And there's only one Davidson County. There's only one blue county.
Wow.
That's Davidson.
Wow. Sarah, thanks for your vote for Bernie. I'm with you. I agree with you, and I wish you the best in sharing that message with your friends. You will be amazed. I'm telling you. I lived in Vermont when Bernie was running for the House of Representatives for re-election in the 2000 election, and George W. Bush was running for president. And Louise and I drove all over the state, and you would see, particularly up in the Northeast Kingdom of part of Vermont, which is arguably more conservative than red parts of Tennessee. Yeah, everybody had a George Bush sign in their front yard, and right next to it was a Bernie sign. People, even Republicans, when they hear what Bernie's positions are on the issues, they get it. And they say, yeah, this is not Democratic Republican. This isn't left or right. Bernie is not far left. He doesn't represent, quote, the left. Bernie represents America. He represents American values. He represents where this country has historically been. And we have been so twisted out of where we should be by these billionaires and their paid shills that up has become down. It's just incredible. And to call somebody who says that he wants to expand Social Security when 70% of Americans want that to happen, to call him a lefty when, you know, 70% of Americans want something, that's the middle of the country. That's mainstream policy. Sarah, thank you for the call. Good on you. Kenyatta in Redlands, California. Hey, Kenyatta, what's up?
Hello, Tom. I want to talk about the indictments this morning, and that's a good thing. But Ms. Mosby is really doing this to get ahead of this thing. And what I mean by that, you recall that we spoke on Monday, the day of Freddie Gray's funeral, and I told you about the technique of twisting up a suspect.
Right.
The autopsy report is going to be explosive when released. Miss Mosby had to get these guys off the street because I'm going to tell you something. When you see what's in, and I haven't seen it, but I know police tactics and I know what happened to this guy. I'm pretty close to knowing. And when you see, when that gets out into the public, she will have to have done something or they'll level that city. And so I think that that's why she's done this. I don't think that it's all altruistic, reasoning. I wanted to say this too. I find it odd that there is no conspiracy charge against these officers because I think the stops that they didn't report, they knew when that guy got in that van that he was really messed up. And I think what they were trying to do is buy time, get their story together. You're going to find at the end of the day there's a lot of collusion in this thing. And I'm really interested in knowing why there isn't a conspiracy charge, because the conspiracy charge would actually have a heavier penalty in terms of jail time.
Well, it may be, Kenyatta, you know, that there's no conspiracy charge because they don't yet have evidence of a conspiracy, and that if one of these six officers flips and turns state's evidence, then you'll see conspiracy charges.
Well, apparently there's one who's apparently continuing to plead the fifth, which is interesting in and of itself. The other thing I wanted to touch on, Tom, was Slap Mom. And I want to get your opinion on that, because right. Bill O'Reilly and that whole crew at Fox are applauding this woman. Oh, and that's what we needed, more Slap Moms out there, and there would have been any riot. But I wanted to look at the flip side of this. You know, other than that circumstance, that particular day, if someone had done that out in public to their child, they'd be up on child abuse charges.
Right.
And what's the dog whistle there? What are these Fox people saying? When are they saying? Because what I'm getting from that is really what we need to do is go out and beat those you know what's up.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds like to me. What do you think?
I went off on this yesterday or the day before, actually, I think that it's a racist meme. I think that, and that's the reason why the whole right wing and Fox News are so in love with this woman. I think that there's two subtexts to this. The first subtext is these African Americans, these young black kids are so much like animals that you just, you know, if you want to make them behave, you have to hit them. Right. I mean, that's the message I think that, you know, the white racists are pushing, number one. And number two is, oh, it's all about personal responsibility, the old Republican meme, right? If only every parent would take care of their kids, there would be no problems, which conveniently lets them ignore things like white privilege built into our society, institutional racism built into our society, 400 years of segregation, oppression, and genocide built into our society, massive wealth disparities, all the things that led to and not to mention police violence. It lets them ignore all of that stuff and just focus on Slap Mom. And I think it's horrible, frankly. Kenyatta, thank you very much for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I guess our offer for folks to come in and do an hour with you all is spreading around the internet. What's news with Cruz? Welcome back. Brian, watching Free Speech TV in Matthews, North Carolina. What's on your mind, Brian?
Hi, Professor. How are you?
I'm great. I'm not a professor, but thank you for the call.
No, I'm sorry. We hold you in such high esteem. Sorry.
Thank you, Brian.
I'm going to start out by saying you have an exceptional crew there. Absolutely. Danielle and Shano, I never had a chance to speak with Shano, but I do listen to him. But I spoke with Danielle on a number of occasions, and it's no wonder why they're part of the team.
Yeah, they're great. They are great. And so is Jim, who our video guy who is...
Sorry, Jim, not to leave you out. I'm
making
sorry.
It all visible. Yep.
my point is, I have actually two points here. This one has always bothered me, especially in the black community. With the amount of vitriol and venom and hate that's pumped into the ether, can we ever truly turn this around? Because it's good we can legislate and put body cameras on and put people in jail. But if our national platform is always telling the other to hate that one, hate that group or whatever, we're never going to change the minds and the hearts of some of these people, and especially the power machine going.
Yeah.
Number two, with it being so moneyed in politics, can you ever come back from that? Every person has their price at every level. And if everything's about money, can you ever turn it around to where we're going to be back to where the arc swings the other way?
Yeah, that's...
And you can expound those two for me.
That's the issue that I really... That's your second part of your question was the issue that I was confronting in my book, The Crash of 2016. And the whole point of that book is that it takes an economic crisis to reboot the body politic of our country, apparently. It's happened three times in the history of our country, maybe arguably four times, and I think it's going to happen again. I think we're right on the edge of it. I think all this, outpouring of support for Bernie, for example, is a sign that we're close to that particular kind of tipping point. Your first question was about what?
With so much hate that's always pushed out there, especially from our from Washington.
Oh, our.
They're always,
And the situation with race in the country. It's all about the money, Brian. It's all about the money.
But can you ever change that? I mean,
I think so. I think, we were on our way in the 1960s, 1970s, and very early 1980s before Reagan came into office. We were on our way to, the white middle class, which pretty much did not exist before 1900. The census of 1900, white people in this country had an average wealth of, in today's dollars, $7,000. There was... this was the whole thing of the Gilded Age. Everybody was poor except for, these pockets of fabulous riches. And out of the Great Depression and out of the New Deal, we built a white middle class going into the 50s and 60s. And, my dad was part of that. And then out of that, I mean, a lot of people of color were excluded from that for a lot of years, even by unions. But sort of out of that, and then explicitly out of the Great Society, out of Lyndon Johnson's presidency, we started building a black middle class. And both of those middle classes were being built on manufacturing, on good jobs where people could make a decent living and raise their family, and we made things in the United States. And so I think if we were to change our trade policies, bring our jobs back home, we'd put people back to work. Both, devastated white communities and devastated black communities as well, and we could go get back to rebuilding our middle class in both cases. So that's my take on that. Brian, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, who want you to know that this Mother's Day, you can give a crystal heart to your mother. It's the mother-to-mother program from goatsfortheoldgoat.com. And these are hearts made by women in South Sudan who have seen somebody killed in their family in front of them. This is this PTSD program that Ellen herself started over there. James Cullum is on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service live from Baltimore. Hey, James.
Tom, it's a pleasure to talk with you, as always.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us. So what's up in Baltimore right now? We've heard about and talked about the police indictments.
Well, I don't know what you've told your listeners so far, but the six officers involved in arresting Freddie Gray have been charged with charges ranging from manslaughter to murder. Yesterday, the Associated Press came out with a story detailing a little bit of the background of one of the arresting officers, and his name is Lieutenant Brian Rice, and he has had a long history the last 3 years he's had a history of mental illness and a history of violence and with guns, and he was suspended two times, once in 2012 and once in 2013, because he was considered to be a threat to himself and to others, and he was put in mental hospitals for evaluation. So we're going to see what happens from that. But the scene here, we are near West and North Pennsylvania Avenues in Baltimore, and it's jubilation. People are very happy. Let me give you a couple of quotes here from the ground. This is from Dominique Cunningham, who said, "I love my city, and unfortunately Freddie Gray had to die, but he did not die in vain. This is going to start a revolution in this city and in this country." Here's from Loring Cornish, who says, "Finally, somebody has taken a stand against what has been happening here in Baltimore for years. People are honking their horns, and they're raising their fists to the air, and they're shouting and dancing in the streets here in Baltimore."
So, James, what was her name? Ms. Mosby, as I recall, the state prosecutor. Haven't said her name enough times here to have it memorized. Marilyn Mosby. When she made the announcement, one of the questions that one of the reporters asked her was, are these six officers in custody? and she said that the arrest warrants had just been issued. Do you know the status of these six folks?
You know, I'm not there. I do not know the status of that situation, so I'm not familiar with it, Tom.
Okay. And why is it that she was able to do this without going to a grand jury, whereas in Ferguson and in New York and other places, they go to a grand jury? Are the rules different in Maryland, or did she just do something that other prosecutors could have done, but they didn't, you know, they passed the buck to the grand jury? What's the situation with that?
Well, I can't tell you anything as far as protocol goes. I can only tell you what's happening here on the ground. And and what's happened here this week has been the feeling that if these officers were not charged, if something did not happen, if the report that came back, the internal investigation that came back to the mayor on May 1st did not have, if those officers were not charged for manslaughter or for murder, people were saying that this city was going to burn. And that it was going to be real bad news. So the tensions have been very high here. As you can see on the news, it's been a little blown out of proportion, but there are very riled tensions here, and people don't trust the police. They've been saying it's happening for years. So
yeah, it's like 400 years.
They really wanted to have some kind of a resolution. I don't know what the protocols in Baltimore are specifically as to that, though.
Right. Okay. James, did you have other news of the world or the day that you wanted to share with us, or are you mostly focused on Baltimore right now?
We're mostly focused on Baltimore right now, trying to see what's going to happen. We were here a few days ago. We're going to stay until after the curfew, and we do not anticipate that there's going to be a problem here in the city, but, you know, we will be here until probably 11 o'clock tonight.
Okay, great. Well, I look forward to talking with you tomorrow, perhaps, and tomorrow's Saturday, isn't it? Monday, and we'll find out what happened. James Cullum with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, James.
Absolutely. Check out our pictures and our stories on Talk Radio News. Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, you got it. Talkradionews.com. Thank you, James. And much appreciated. Donald in Chicago. Hey, Donald, what's on your mind today?
Yes, Tom. Do you hear me okay?
Yes, I do.
Okay. The thing is what really gets me, as some of these Bible toters, they're shoving this biblical prophecies down our throat. You know, they are such hypocrites because of the fact that they're so anxious to go meet their creator. If you tell any one of them that they got cancer and they're dying, you'd be surprised how fast they go to any doctor to start saving their lives. They're afraid of death, but they just don't want to die alone. They want to take everybody with them. And if they keep going down this road, we will have a biblical prophecy because they're nuts. They want to get us into wars, and it drives me crazy.
Yeah, I'm with you, Donald, and it's one of the things that's driving the giant Republican money machine, and why they're all, you know, swearing their loyalty and eternal love to Israel is because many of these fundamentalist Christians, you know, are waiting for the time when all the Jews in Israel, except for the 144,000 select who become Christians, are, you know, die, and it's hysterical. It's weird. Donald, thank you for the call. Larry in New Orleans got a quick one, Larry. We just have a minute to the break.
Yeah, I wanted to say that I'm kind of witnessing the Great Awakening because people here, I canvass for solar on a daily basis, and I talk to people who have all this misinformation about solar and how it pays back and how the tax credits actually pay for themselves because of the multiplier effect. A lot of people just simply aren't aware of that, and you know, until they talk to me. And there's many other issues as well where you'd think here in a red state there'd be no breaking through. But people are actually saying that, you know, solar does pay off.
That's great. In Louisiana. Are those state tax credits or federal tax credits?
The state tax credits are actually being cut July 1st. Jindal is going to be.
Of course. It's Bobby Jindal's state. Okay. Larry, thank you for the call. I think we're hitting tipping points all over the place, and energy is one of them. Elon Musk has got a lot to do with that. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. A couple of things I just wanted to basically go off on, and then back to your phone calls because it's Anything Goes Friday. But the Supreme Court on Wednesday, day before yesterday, in a 5-4 decision in a case called Williams Yulee v. Florida Bar, the Supreme Court said that the states may, quote, prohibit judges and judicial candidates from personally soliciting funds for their campaigns. So this is John Roberts writing for the court. He wrote, states may regulate judicial elections differently than they regulate political elections because the role of judges differs from the role of politicians. Politicians are expected to be appropriately responsive to the preferences of their supporters. Really? Honest to God, the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court wrote that in a Supreme Court decision? He said, indeed, such responsiveness is key to the very concept of self-governance through elected officials. Well, yes, if you're talking about what the people want you to do, then, yeah, we elect officials. You know, people wanted Social Security. We elected officials who brought us Social Security. People wanted unionization. But that's a completely different thing than the preferences of your supporters. He goes on to say, the same is not true of judges. In deciding cases, a judge is not to follow the preference of his supporters or to provide any special consideration to his campaign donors. Instead, he's got to observe the utmost fairness and all that kind of thing. So, basically, yesterday, John Roberts issued a ruling, or, you know, a Supreme Court decision saying that politicians are supposed to do what their supporters tell them to. Keep in mind, the context of this decision was money for election campaigns being given to judges. And he's saying, no, it's fine that money is given to politicians because we expect politicians to respond to the people who are giving them the money. Or at least that's how I'm reading this. And that's, you know, certainly was that logic can be found in Citizens United. But judges, you know, they're not supposed to be responsive they're supposed to be responsive to the law. Now, I understand that. But to say that politicians are, it's this is like Alice in Wonderland stuff. And it's an indication of how out of touch this court, or at least the five right-wing crazy majority on this court, the Tea Party majority on the Supreme Court, how out of touch they are with just fundamental notions of democratic institutions, small d democratic institutions, or small r republican institutions, democratic institutions in a republic, for that matter. Okay, a couple other things. Yesterday, the House of Representatives voted on an amendment offered by Steve King to the 2016 Military Construction and Veterans Affairs Appropriations Act, and it would prohibit any funds from the act being used to carry out Davis-Bacon wage requirements. Now, What is this all about? This is another classic example. I tell you, I keep telling you, the Republican Party is made up of the very rich people, the paid shills for the very rich people, and the suckers that they can bring along. In this case, Steve King, one of the paid shills for the very rich people, is all upset about Davis Bacon. Davis Bacon is a law that goes back to the 30s, if my recollection is correct, which says that when the government goes into a community and does something, builds something, hires people, or hires contractors who are doing something, that the employees, the people working, have to be paid, quote, the prevailing wage, which is going to be, you know, higher in New York City or Chicago than it will be in, you know, a little town in rural Kentucky, for example. But they have to pay the prevailing wage. In other words, workers deserve a fair paycheck. And, of course, the Republicans don't agree with that. They don't think that workers do deserve fair paychecks. They want workers fighting against each other. They want you know, they pit the working class against the working class, pit the working class against the poor, pit, you know, divide and conquer. And why is it that as Republicans are voting to reduce the pay of working people across the United States in federally funded projects, that the media is not reporting on this? Why? Why is there no word of this on the press? I mean, Steve King is bragging about it to his peeps, you know, to his folks. I mean, this is the press release I got is from heritageaction.com. This is the Heritage Foundation. And the headline is Yes on King Amendment to Stop Davis Bacon. The Heritage Foundation, of course, an organization funded and founded by a bunch of billionaires. This is the way it is. Oh, and a quick geeky science, and then I'll pick up your phone calls. This I thought was fascinating. This is in over at scienceworldreport.com. And I don't have a name for the author, so I can't credit the author on this. But it says, want to stay healthy? Then walk 2 minutes every hour. Scientists have found that walking just 2 minutes each hour can offset the hazards of sitting for long periods of time. Sitting for extended periods of time every day, which most of us do at work, leads to increased risk for early death, heart disease, diabetes, other conditions. 80% of Americans fail short of completing the recommended amount of exercise, which is 2.5 hours of moderate activity a week. But they discovered that if you just every hour walk for 2 minutes, it was associated with a 33% lower risk of dying. How amazing is that? So now I know what I'm doing during the breaks. Okay, Carol in Jewell, Iowa. Hey, Carol, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Hey. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First-time caller.
Thank you.
I'm really torn. I'd really like to see a woman in office before I move on, but I just love what Bernie Sanders has to say.
Me too. I would vote for either one of them. Whoever the party's nominee is, I will vote for enthusiastically.
Me too. But my question is, I know, like in Kentucky with Rand Paul, he can't run for his Senate seat. Bernie up for re-election?
Say what?
Is Bernie up for re-election in 2016?
I don't believe so. I'm pretty sure that he's up for re-election in 2018 because he just recently won re-election.
I think
it was. Yeah, I'll have to check on that, but I'm pretty sure he's not up for re-election in 2016, Carol.
Because we wouldn't want to lose one of our greatest senators.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that Vermont has a law. In fact, I think if they did, we would have heard about it by now. Unlike Kentucky, that says that you can't run for two offices at once. So, if he is up for re-election in 2016, my guess is the good citizens of Vermont will vote for him for Senate as well as president. But he's up for re-election in 2018. Shano just tracked it down, so not an issue, Carol. Not to worry. Okay.
Just one more thing.
Yes.
it turns my stomach that Steve King is my representative.
Oh, really? Congressman King, who wants to do away with Davis Bacon. Amazing. Well, Carol, you have my sympathy. I Newt Gingrich was my representative when I lived in Georgia, in the suburban Atlanta for years. So I can sympathize with you. Thanks for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back with more of your calls right after this. And welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. And let's see here. Jesse, watching Free Speech TV in Miami. Hey, Jesse, what's up?
Hey, hi, Tom. Hey, thank God for Bernie running for president.
Amen.
It reminds me of a Chris Rock joke talking about George Bush made it so bad for white men that white men can't be president no more. I think Bernie could turn that around.
I think so.
Yeah. Hey, the thing about the, what was it? I forgot already. Let me see. It was about the, wow, I can't remember. Oh, okay, well...
Law enforcement, corrupt ruling class. That's what I've got here as the notes when you talked to Danielle.
If we have a corrupt ruling class and the capitalist system is pretty much corrupt, what can we expect from the system?
Well, the system...
The other one that pops to mind, too, I hope Bernie realized that the whole world is running on fiat money. And I'd like to hear your comment.
Yeah.
Thanks for all you do.
Thank you, Jesse. Thank you very much for the call. Well, yeah, with regard to fiat money, the whole world has always run on fiat money. There's, you know, this idea that money should have intrinsic value, but I remember going down to Peru and visiting Corral. I wrote about it in one of my books. I'm pretty sure it's in Threshold, the chapter about it. Corral is the oldest mother city. In fact, it's the first mother city that's ever been discovered intact. A mother city is the first city created, when a group of people moved from being hunter-gatherers to being urban dwellers, to being city dwellers. And there are a bunch of mother cities around the world, like Jerusalem and Rome and I mean, you know, there's a bunch of them, but we can't get to the original layer, right? To the when it started. But Corral started 5,000 years ago, and if my recollection is correct, and then there was a microclimate shift, a change, a local change in the climate, and it got covered with sand. I mean, it's right by the coast of Peru. And it got covered with sand and vanished. And it was this large, sophisticated city with pyramids and an amphitheater that has been excavated. I stood in the middle of it. The acoustics are so astonishing. You can stand in the middle of this thing and just say a word. And the form of money that they used was a string. They grew cotton. Was string that had knots in it. It's fiat money. Right? It doesn't have an intrinsic value. And so what you find is that the money of a society, of a culture, is not as good as the value of the money itself. The value of the money is as good as the culture itself, or the society, or the government, or however you want to describe that. And so, you know, I don't have a problem with fiat money. I know that there are people who think that we should go to the gold standard and all our coins should be, you know, gold and silver and all this kind of stuff. I'm not one of those people. As your economy expands, you need to expand your money supply. If your economy contracts, you need to contract your money supply. It needs to be flexible. And buying and selling gold to do that in Fort Knox got real unwieldy, particularly as our economy really started growing after World War II. And this is why Richard Nixon closed the gold window in 72. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and David in Wellington, Florida. Hey, David, what's up?
Oh, hey, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. I just want to make sure I'm on a Bluetooth. Can you hear me, Tom?
Yeah, it sounds fine, David.
Oh, okay, great. I was calling a couple of things, but mostly, Tom, I just wanted to show a lot of us how excited I am that Bernie has decided to announce that he's running for president.
Yeah.
I just wanted to point out, you know, the whole inevitability notion for Hillary, it's a campaign tactic, and it's been in vogue in recent years. She tried it in the race. She tried to get it now. Bloomberg did it in New York. I just want to point out the most successful recent progressive election in the country is Bill de Blasio running for mayor of New York with anybody but Quinn. That was the whole thing that got his campaign started. It was very successful.
Right, and Quinn was supposed to be the inevitable candidate, yeah.
The Bloomberg-supported bipartisan inevitable candidate, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, and de Blasio, as you know, campaigning openly as a progressive, you know, aggressively as a progressive, with big ideas and bold ideas, as the PCCC says, you know, it worked. I think it was a great thing. So, yeah, thank you, David. I agree with you. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, thanks for listening to KTNF. What's up?
Hey, Tom. John in Minneapolis.
Hey, John.
I just wanted to talk about, you know, the problem with the police departments across the country and the, you know, the abuse and the corruption. But I think it's really important that people understand that the corruption starts at the top, and it's intertwined with the criminal justice system, and it's intertwined with the criminal judicial system.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't change what's going on from that end, which is, I believe, where it started, and I'm not indicting every judge or every lawyer, but those who operate in that criminal justice system
mm-hmm.
are part of the problem. And we really need to, that I believe that's where it started, because when you have, you know, abuse and corruption, it starts typically with the most powerful in the system. And I think that's what's enabled the police to be able to get away with it for so long.
I agree. Police brutality goes, I mean, you know, there are stories about police brutality coming from the Roman Empire. I mean, it's just people who have power over others and have the state authorize them to have the power of life and death over other people with very little accountability will very often be corrupted by that power. And what we need to do is dial back that power. And the way you do that is with accountability, is with oversight. So, yeah.
Right.
Excellent.
I mean, states and in the judiciary and the legislators have given up their authority, and you know, there's no citizen oversight, and there's even no legislative oversight in a lot of those areas anymore. And that's what has to change in the laws. We've got to have citizen oversight with some
right, and we're seeing that
strength to
we're seeing that start. I mean, it was a white guy in Wisconsin whose son was killed 10 years ago by a police officer, and the officer was never charged with anything because, you know, they did the whole, oh, let's ask the grand jury, oh, nothing wrong with, you know, no droids in that car kind of thing. And this guy went on this campaign, and it took him a decade to get a law passed in Wisconsin that says that the prosecutors who work with the police and the grand juries who work with the police cannot be involved in determining wrongdoing on the part of the police, that it's going to be an independent citizens commission. This is now the law in Wisconsin. It's the only state in the country where this is the law.
Yeah.
And it was passed by citizen referendum. It was not passed by the legislature, if my recollection is correct. But I think it's the beginning of a wave of that sort of thing, John, and all across the country we're seeing more and more of this. It's a good thing. We need to be pushing for it. John, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening to Minnesota's Progressive Talk. Woody in Litchfield Park, Arizona. Hey, Woody, what's on your mind?
Well, thanks for letting me back again, Tom. Well, real quick comment about Mr. Roberts. Last I checked, it was the legislature who gave the laws that the judges weigh in on.
Well, you know, tell that to John Marshall in 1803 in Marbury. You know, tell that to Roger Taney in 1856 with Dred Scott. Tell that to John Roberts. You're right. But this Supreme Court is completely out of control.
Yes. But I wanted to get back to Baltimore. My experience, I grew up just north of Baltimore in Towson, got lots of stories. But one that comes to mind in this Freddie Gray story is when I was in college, I was in a fraternity. We had a little room where we used to go get high back in 1972, 73. And so I walk into the room one day, and, you know, I had a beard and long hair, ponytail down the back. And there are these guys that look kind of like I do now. I'm 60, short hair, whatever. And I pass them a joint, and I say, hey, what do you guys do? No, oh, we're Baltimore City police detectives. Oh, that's interesting. I have another hit. So I asked him, well, what do you think of this deal with the drug laws? And they say, well, it's a pretty sweet deal. We can pull over somebody that looks like you. We'll search the car. We'll probably find some pot and maybe something to smoke it with. We'll tell you, we'll let you go this time, but, you know, straighten up and fly right. They smoke what they want. They throw it away, and they go on down the road. And I don't think we've gone too much past that. I've gotten high with county attorneys, with police, you know, beat cops, et cetera. It's such a disparity between, and again, it's I'm white, obviously, and that's one of the big key factors.
So you're telling a white privilege story here, basically.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Very much a white privilege story, as well as the idiocy of our drug laws.
Yeah.
I did want to get a plug in. Arizona has Safer Arizona initiative coming through to legalize marijuana. And tomorrow at 3:30 at Steel Park in Phoenix, there's a rally for re-legalize all drugs. And a real quick story about my dad who passed away in 64.
Just got 20 seconds.
From liver cancer, or actually pancreatic. But Mom learned how to give him morphine shots. And there was no regulatory control then. And it was a damn good thing because he was in such pain.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Woody, thank you very much for the call, and I'm with you. The drug wars and white privilege are like hand in glove, and the evidence is absolutely overwhelming. And, you know, when for example, Hillary Clinton says it's time for an end to the era of mass incarceration, I'm absolutely with her. We need to go a step further, though, and identify why that thing happened. Why is it that Ronald Reagan amped up the drug war so aggressive? It was racism.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Or more correctly, it was a shout out by the shills for the rich people, in this case Reagan, to the suckers, to the white racists. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Anything Goes Friday. Six police officers indicted for charges varying from murder to essentially dereliction of duty. Don't have the exact phrase in front of me, but words to that effect. In Baltimore, it seems like a good thing. Holding police to account. This is, and I'm not anti-cop. I, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but, you know, I have good friends who are cops, or I have had through the course of my life. I you know, at the moment, I have one friend who's a cop, and actually, he's an ex-cop. But in any case, he still plays the bagpipe at police funerals. A good guy. But when you give somebody the power of life or death and you have the state back them up in that, that is an incredible amount of power, and something has to constrain that power. And it needs to be we the people. I mean, it's just like, you know, when somebody has billions of dollars or when a corporation is very, very wealthy, that's an enormous amount of power. And something has to constrain that power. Something has to balance the power of organized money. And the idea of the founders was that the power of organized money, which they fought against from the Boston Tea Party forward, the power of organized money has to be countered by the power of organized people, which is we the people. In other words, government. And so government needs to the extent that government empowers police, it also needs to regulate police to establish accountability. To the extent that government creates a marketplace, which we do, there would be no business in this country without government, or there would be very little. To the extent that government creates a marketplace, it also has an obligation to make sure that that marketplace is serving society, not just the major players in the marketplace. So just, you know, a whole bunch of pretty straightforward stuff. Jerry in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind?
Well,
I was listening about the Republicans talking about that woman that beat up her kid and got him out of the riots and whatnot. And
yeah.
They're saying that all parents should do that.
Yeah, slap mom, they're calling her.
You think about it, the economic situation, well, out here in the Seattle area, is that a working-class family has got to have two parents working to afford the real estate around here. And there's no mother to stay home and raise the kid and teach him right.
Right.
And so that's one point.
But, Jerry, I don't think that that's the story here. And I don't think that that's the storyline. I think the storyline and the reason why Slap Mom is being held up by Fox News as the hero of the year, in my opinion, is twofold. Number one, it allows them to ignore or to avoid talking about systemic racism, about why people are poor, why black people are poor, why they're essentially segregated, why the African American community, the black community has been basically kept in these neighborhoods. And the money that is made off them, by the way, whether it's, you know, the local quick stops and whatnot that sell them wildly overpriced junk food, or whether it's the local police departments using them as an ATM machine. It allows them to ignore all that. That's the first one. And the second one is that it promotes the meme that white racists love, which is that the only way that you can deal with black people who are behaving badly is to beat the crap out of them, which is what Slap Mom did with her son. I mean, she didn't, you know, it wasn't totally over the top, but it was physical violence against a person of color. And so, of course, Bill O'Reilly's going to jump up and applaud it. Back to you, Jerry.
Yeah, well, that's one point, and well taken, that it's kind of like, when they've got the privatized prisons and whatnot, they're guaranteed payment for empty beds.
Yep.
They got to fill them somehow, and that's what the privatizing.
Yeah, it's a big problem all across the country. I don't know to what extent that may have anything to do with Baltimore, but it's a real that privatized prisons is insane. Privatizing our prisons is almost as crazy as privatizing our vote, and we've done both, and it's nuts.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm glad to see Barney jumped into the race. And I only wish that Elizabeth Warren and Jesse Ventura would join him.
Yes, on Elizabeth Warren. Jesse, I don't know what he's up to these days. He's doing some interesting television from down in Mexico. So, a Sanders Warren ticket would be awesome. Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. Harrison in Walla Walla, Washington. Hey, Harrison, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me, and happy International Workers' Day.
Thank you. Back at you.
Yeah, so I'm a student in Washington. I'm actually studying abroad here in Denmark right now. And since I've been here, I've noticed that, you know, to have a democracy function, you really need an educated citizenry.
Are you calling me from Denmark?
Bernie. I am.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, it sounds great.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Back to what you were saying. Forgive the interruption, please.
Yeah, no problem. So here in Denmark, students have access to tuition-free university. In fact, they're paid to attend college. So, you know, you have a highly educated citizenry that are much more engaged politically, and they have a proportional representation system. So people, it's not that they think that it's perfect, but it's certainly better. It's more democratic. It's more fair. And so people can form, you know, multiple parties if they're not happy with the ones that are on the ballot. So it's such a better system. And in Norway, they're 74% of the elections are publicly financed. And so what I would love to see is proposals for not just overturning Citizens United, but going far beyond that to ban corporate lobbying. And there's a lot of rhetoric around this. It doesn't mean people can't petition the government. It just means you can't buy the government. So
right.
Banning corporate lobbying and doing public financing with a proportional system, with a national voting holiday. And if we had, my point is, if we had tuition-free college, I would feel much better about having a national referendum process. When you had an educated American public, we could vote on things like climate
right.
change. But it's hard to have people voting on science and on other bills when they're not informed. And it's not that they don't have the capacity to be informed. It's that to become educated in the United States requires either you go into debt or you come from a rich family. And it's just, it's not fair, and it doesn't allow for democracy to actually exist.
I agree. Harrison, yeah, absolutely. We, Louise and I did this, we went to Denmark, what was it, 4 years ago or so? We did our show for maybe it was just one week. From the studios of Danish Radio, they were kind enough to loan us a studio that we could use. And they have a very robust media landscape, by the way, in Denmark. But because most of what I do, or a lot of what I do on my program, is debate conservatives, we had a local person, a local Danish political science student, actually, who was working at Danish Radio, who we were able to kind of hire for a week as an on-the-ground producer. And I said, get me the most, you know, hardcore conservatives in Denmark, you know, politicians and, mm-hmm. and people in the media, and I want to interview them on the radio. And she got me the guy who published the newspaper that had originally published the Muhammad cartoons, I think, or something like that, you know. Mm-hmm. And he's a very hardcore right-winger. And she got me the head of, you know, one of the most senior conservative politicians in the Danish parliament. And with the politician, for example, I said, okay, so you're a conservative. And he's like, yeah. And so I said, so you must want to privatize your country's national healthcare system. And he's like, what, are you crazy? And I said,
and I said,
but you're a conservative, so you must want to do away with free public education, free college for, and in fact, they pay, I think it's about $200 a month stipend, isn't it, that they give to Danish students to pay for, you know, books food and stuff.
It's actually even more than that, actually.
Yeah. Okay. And I said, so you must want to do away with that. Right. And he said, what, are you crazy? You want me to ruin my country? And I said, then what is it that makes you a conservative? And he said, I don't want any more immigrants coming into this country. It was all about race. That's what defines conservative in Northern Europe, and you know go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, students are paid in roughly about $900 to go to college that's free, and that includes grad school, it includes medical school. And my neighbor here in my dormitory where I live is a Danish student. He's studying to become a doctor, and neither of his parents went to college. And so I said, how does it feel? And he said, well, I feel I have the opportunity, and so it's incredible. And I said, well, you know, in the U.S., a lot of people who are studying in med school have so much debt that they're like, I need to make a ton of money to pay off my debt. And he said, no, I'm doing this to help people, and I don't have to worry about debt because I don't have debt. In fact, I'm paid to go to school.
Right.
And so they have a system where – there's less anxiety here. I mean, it's really, really remarkably different, and it's better. I mean, it's absolutely better.
The year that we did our show from Denmark was the year – what provoked us to do Denmark specifically was that I think it was Fortune magazine or whatever, but it was rated the happiest country on earth, and I think you're describing why.
Yeah. I mean, the weather is kind of strange, but the people are very, very – at ease here. It's a great country.
And a lot of bicycles.
I've been trying to get Bernie and other people to talk about, you know, proportional representation. That way Bernie could run as an independent, he could run as a green, he could run as whatever he wanted, but he wouldn't be beholden to the two parties.
That is a major reboot, Harrison. It's a great campaign to start talking about, and it's a major reboot. Thank you for the call, and thanks for calling in from Denmark.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. We will be back with more of your calls. Anything Goes Friday right after this. Welcome back. Ron in Yoder, Indiana, watching on freespeech.org. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Yeah, hey, that last caller was right on. That national voting holiday would be perfect.
Yeah.
What I'd like to say is I'd like to thank Bernie for running, and I think it's going to take a huge groundswell, not a lot of money, but people. Mm-hmm. And they need to get off their butts, get out there and vote, or volunteer, whatever they can do. And I just think it's going to be hard, but it can be done.
Yeah, I agree. If this is going to be a test, you know, this is a test, not of Bernie, But this is a test of how robust the political system in the United States is, and intermeshed with our political system is our media system, and it's going to be a test of our media system as well.
Right.
So, yeah,
right.
I'm with you, Ron. Thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you, Kelly in Chicago. Hey, Kelly, what's up?
Oh, hi. How are you doing?
Good.
Okay, Tom, what I wanted to say was I noticed something. Lisa just came to me one day. Have you noticed something that in the wild, if you ever watch the TV shows, and they'll have a whole a pride of animals running around, and if they find one dead, what do? Oh, they'll have a tag attached to it, and they can sit up there and tell you the whole history of this particular animal from the time it was a cub to the time they found it dead, correct?
Mm-hmm. I've never seen the show, but I believe you.
I'm just saying, but that's what they do. They tag the animals to keep track of them. And I believe that that's the same exact thing they do to our young black men. And the reason I say that is if you really take an account to how many, every time you get arrested, even if it's just for a stop, you get your fingerprints taken and you get your picture taken. Now, every last, just about, I'll just say about 60, 70% of black people, I guarantee you have a mugshot and fingerprints. Especially for the young black men.
Yeah, it's. I think it's at any given moment, roughly 10% of the black male population of this country is involved in some way with the criminal justice system, whether they're on parole or probation or in jail or just arrested or whatever. And that's a crime. That's a moral crime in the richest country on earth. It's a crime.
And I just want to say this because I have a really good young male, and he's 20 years old. He went to Urban Prep, and I know you're familiar with that here in the Chicago area. Well, anyway, in his sophomore year of high school, he was coming home. We made sure he stayed in full uniform, tie, suit, you know, everything, so no one can distinguish him between the one standing on the street corner and the fact that he's a student. He took off his blazer one day. He had his white shirt on with his red, with his a gold tie, because you get a gold tie for when you're doing something extra special.
Mm-hmm.
Two police officers almost ran him over,
threw
him up against the gate near my home, and threatened him. And he's like, I'm just coming from school. He's nervous, had never been involved with the police whatsoever, just because he was coming across the area where the people were hanging out. But he was dressed to show that he was not like them. And he was like, well, I'm a student. We don't give a F. We can put these drugs on you right now.
Wow.
You know, and shook him.
Wow. See, that's terrorism, Kelly. That's terrorism. And the black community in this country has been the victims of terrorism since the beginning, you know, since the 1600s, when people were brought here from Africa by white terrorists. And it's time for the system, this organized system of terrorism, to come to an end. Kelly, thank you for the call. Thanks for sharing your story. We'll be back. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Nate Sweet and Troy Miller, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, all the folks who syndicate our program, Westwood One, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV, Dish Network, DirecTV, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others. All the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Radio, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in the chat room. Hey, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman-Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. And thank you for letting our advertisers know that you are listening and you're supporting them. If you're listening on a commercial station, for supporting our non-commercial stations with their fund drives, and all that sort of thing. Thank you so much for keeping this program on the air. It is truly appreciated. Kathy in Chicago. Hey, Kathy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to know what you think about Bernie increasing the chances of Republicans winning the election.
If Bernie was running as Ralph Nader did, as an independent, or as what's Ross Perot did? Yeah, thank you, Shano. My alternate brain here. As Ross Perot did, then yeah, I think that there's a possibility that he could harm either himself or Hillary or whoever ends up being the Democratic nominee and get a Republican elected. But he's not doing it that way. He's chosen specifically not to do it that way. He's instead running in the Democratic primary. And I think that if Hillary is the ultimate candidate, Bernie being there will have made her a better candidate. And on the other hand, if Bernie wins the Democratic primary, I think there's a very good possibility that he could be president of the United States. And I'm, you know, I think I'm a pretty clear-eyed realist. As much as, you know, there is a lot of idealism in me, I have seen Bernie do this year after year after year in Vermont. I used to live in Vermont, and I knew conservatives, Fox News, top to bottom watchers who voted for Bernie year after year. And I think that Bernie can bring in everybody because his message is the fundamental American message. It's the American dream message.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know. I don't think he's going to screw things up for the probability of a Democrat being elected at all. I think he's going to enhance the probability of a Democrat being elected because regardless of who the Democrat is, Bernie's making it very clear that the Republican Party stands for the rich and the well-connected. And the Democratic Party stands for the 99% of the rest of us, you know. And I think that's a message that needs to get out there, and he's doing it. So,
I hope he moves Hillary to the left.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's not his goal, but I think that will inevitably happen. I think it's already happening, and I think that Elizabeth Warren is playing a role in that, too. But I think I don't think that Hillary is responding so much to Bernie as two other things that we have to keep in mind. One, she's not her husband. And when she was a senator, she was the 10th most progressive senator in the entire United States Senate. She was more progressive than a lot of people that we think of as progressive senators. So her voting record is very progressive. And number two, well, actually, I guess that's enough. Number two is she's not going to be responding to Bernie or to Elizabeth Warren. She's going to be responding to the people. This is how politicians, good politicians, competent politicians, is the way that they make their decisions on policy issues is by finding out what the vast majority of the people want. Now, what the way Republicans make the decisions on policy issues is who's paying them to do it. But and there's a little bit of that creeping into the Democratic Party, and it's not a good thing. But to the extent that we're seeing Hillary Clinton now starting to take, quote, left positions, yeah, there's a primary coming up, maybe. But I think that she's actually getting a sense of the times. I think that we are at the leading edge. In fact, I think, frankly, we're 6 years into it, of a progressive revolution in the United States, a progressive movement. The pendulum, the seesaw, whatever you want to call it, is shifting, in my opinion. Kathy, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Lowell in Salem, Oregon. Hey, Lowell, what's up?
Hey, Tom. We miss you in Portland.
Oh, thank you.
I wanted to ask about Senator Patty Murray and the proposal the Democrats seem to have that appears to be undercutting our push for 15. They're proposing 12 by 2020,
right,
which seems to be too... It seems to just be undercutting us, and I wanted to get your take on that.
My take on it is that you have the order of causation backwards. The $12 an hour was based on that the Democrats are proposing was based on two things. Number one, that's roughly what the minimum wage would be if it had been inflation adjusted since the 60s. So, you know, it's not an unreasonable minimum wage. It worked okay in the 60s. And number two, at that point, with that as the price point, as it were, about, I don't know, a quarter, a third, some substantial fraction of the people who are both working and getting government benefits would no longer qualify for government benefits, and so it would lower the costs of those programs. Those were the rationale.
Well,
then along came, after that started, which was years ago, along came the fight for 15. And so I think that the fight for 15 is pulling the move for $12 an hour forward, and frankly, I think it's going to make it even more progressive. I think that the two are going to intersect at some point. Making sense, Lowell?
Yeah, well, let's hope for that, but 12 by 2020 seems like way too little too late.
I agree. But it's, you know, when it was first proposed a couple of years back, it was considered radical. So, I mean, that's how far this country has moved in a progressive direction just during the presidency of Barack Obama. And good on him for that. But Lowell, thank you for the call. And thank you for being with us today and this week. We will be back on Monday. And don't forget, democracy requires you to participate. So check it out. Get active. Tag. You're it. We'll see you on Monday. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.